Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Welcome back to Hackberry House, a podcast devoted to the Word of God and the persecuted church in North Korea. My name is Bob. This is podcast number 543. It is August 10, 2016. Today, part 5 of Fanny Crosby by Bernard Ruffin continues the story of Fanny's younger years and the New York Institution for the Blind. The chapter is called My Happy Home. At 14, Fanny, always diminutive in stature, did not look her age. She was a lively little girl with jet black curls, but not especially attractive. It was clear, however, that she was endowed with a personality of rare intensity and vitality, which tended to express itself in passionate emotions, in violent sorrow as well as violent joy. Whatever she did, whether it was riding horseback, or playing the guitar, singing, telling stories, writing poetry, she did it with a fierce passion that was almost more than her meager frame could bear. It was to be so throughout her life. But, as indicated earlier, she could not throw herself into education. Although she still attended the district school in spurts, the harried schoolmaster, given charge of more students than he could adequately handle, had absolutely no time to give the special attention and training that she needed. So, after attending classes for a few days, Fanny, in despair, would just drop out. This on-and-off-again pattern continued until November 1834, when Mercy read Fanny a circular about the newly founded New York Institution for the Blind. Certain that her prayers to God for a meaningful education had been answered, Fanny clapped her hands and cried out, "Oh, thank God, he's answered my prayer just as I knew he could." 70 years of joys and sorrows later, Fanny could still describe that day as the happiest of my life. For nearly 4 months, mother and daughter made preparations. Both of them knew that separation would be a difficult but necessary cross to be borne. "What will you do without me?" Mercy asked Fanny, undoubtedly asking herself mentally, "What will I do without you?" Fanny assured her mother that, as much as she loved her, she was willing to undergo any sacrifice to obtain an education. "You're right, my child," Mercy said, her voice faint and trembling. "I'm very glad you have the chance to go." D-Day came, March 3rd, 1835. On that morning, Fanny was awakened by Mercy, who told her that the stagecoach was at the door. She had permitted Fanny to sleep until the last possible moment, no doubt in order to spare both of them the agony of a prolonged parting. Fanny was thoroughly unnerved and trembled so badly that she could scarcely dress. Her throat contained such a lump that she could only swallow a few morsels of the breakfast that Mercy had prepared. Trying to force back her sobs, Fanny hurried from the house into the presence of the woman who was to be her traveling companion. She was fearful that she would break down completely if she should turn and say so much as goodbye to her beloved mother. The traveling companion led her to a place in the coach. The stage lurched forward and rumbled onto the newly prepared road to Norwalk, Connecticut, where Fanny and her companion were to take a steamer to Manhattan. The woman, whose name we do not know, tried to get Fanny to talk, but for an hour the girl was silent, too anguished even for tears. Her suffering was apparent. At length the woman said severely, "Fanny, if you don't want to go to New York, we'll get out at the next station and take the returning stage home. Your mother would be lonesome without you anyway." Well, at this point, Fanny probably realized that a return to the frustrating and unrewarding life as the village bard in a rustic Yankee community was not a viable option for her. So she decided to cross the Rubicon by passing up that next station without disembarking. Had I returned to my mother that morning, she later wrote, I would have cast away my pearl of great price, for it is not profitable that I should ever have been, not probable that I should ever have been brave enough to start again for the institution. She set her teeth, told her companion, I will go to New York. Well, Dr. Russ was the superintendent of the institution that she went to. She was much beloved of his pupils. Called a great benefactor of the blind, he invented a phonetic alphabet and worked diligently to perfect the system of raised characters and maps that Louis Braille had developed several years earlier in France. Now, Russ came to the institution when it was founded and served without pay for the first 2 years. Despite a busy schedule and heavy responsibilities, he was never too busy to take a personal interest in his pupils, even teaching Bible classes and reading to them from his favorite poet, Lord Byron. It was to this school that Fanny Crosby arrived on March 7, 1835, and it was here that she would have some of her most important experiences. During the first days of her stay, Fanny was simply homesick. When evening came the first night, she was led to the little room that was to be hers. There, everything was strange, and nothing was in the place where she was accustomed to find it at home. This thoroughly disconcerted the poor girl, and she could not keep the curl from coming to her upper lip. She sat on her trunk and tried to be brave and force back the tears. She was approached by the matron of the institution, whom she described as a motherly Quakeress, who threw her arms about the girl's thin body. Fanny, she said, I guess thee has never been away from home before. No, ma'am, said Fanny weakly, and then added falteringly, please excuse me, I must cry. And she did, loud and long, until one of her fellow pupils succeeded in comforting her. Fanny soon overcame her homesickness, or rather it went away, and she got into the swing of things. Soon the once forbidding institution became, quote, my happy home, and in the next 2 decades she experienced the brightest joys I e'er have known. An outgoing girl, she rapidly made friends, and with her keen mind she quickly mastered her lessons. Among the subjects she was taught in the next few years were English, grammar, science, music, history, philosophy, astronomy, and political economy. The lessons were given to the pupils in the form of lectures and readings. The instructors would read the lesson or lecture 2 or 3 times. This done, the pupils were expected to answer minute and detailed questions on the text that they had heard. The next day, they were to paraphrase the entire lesson. Well, Fanny learned unusually quickly and well, and to the day of her death, she was able to recite the entire text of Brown's Grammar, word for word. Fanny was in love with grammar and philosophy, astronomy, political economy, but she had trouble with Braille and mathematics. She was taught to read the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner in Braille, but apparently did so very slowly and laboriously. Although she said she could recognize a person instantaneously by the touch of the hand, she claimed that she had too poor a sense of touch in her fingers to master the raised alphabet. This she blamed on her guitar playing, which calloused her fingertips. However genuine the causes of her difficulty, after she left the institution, Fanny rarely used Braille. She kept a Braille Bible, but even here relied more upon her memory and training. Whenever she wanted to read a book, she would have someone read it to her. They had only to do so once, and the contents were indelibly stamped upon her remarkable memory. Mathematics was a great monster to her. This subject was taught by means of metal slates with holes in them, with which the pupils could count and realize the numbers as they worked. and by means of three types which could be placed in different positions in a wooden frame to represent certain figures. Fanny was less than enthusiastic about this subject. "I've never been a very good hater," she said later in life, "even when the best material was provided for the purpose, but I found myself an adept at the art of loathing when it came to the science of numbers." She managed to learn addition and subtraction. Multiplication was harder, and when it came to division, Fanny balked entirely. In the institution, the more advanced pupils were sometimes assigned to teach the newer ones. Anna Smith, who later became one of Fanny's most intimate friends, was teaching her, or trying to teach her, arithmetic. After 2 days of multiplication, she had to admit that her pupil had learned absolutely nothing. Dr. Russ was consulted and called Fanny into his office, threatening to, quote, "put me on the mantle." As a result, Fanny got down to work and managed to learn the multiplication tables. Then Anna got to division. There, Fanny's patience failed. She was one of those persons who just cannot learn mathematics, no matter how hard they try. Although the institution had the reputation of being more advanced in mathematics than schools for the sighted, Anna realized that Fanny had no aptitude for figures and told Russ so. The superintendent then wisely decided that Fanny could better spend her time in other studies, so he excused her from taking more arithmetic. "Well, from that hour I was a new creature," Fanny recalled more than 70 years later. "What a nightmare I was escaping." Fanny's favorite avocation continued to be writing poetry. The instructors read the pupils the poems of Thomas Moore, James Montgomery, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Alfred Lord Tennyson, William Cullen Bryant, and Charles Wesley, as well as those of many long-forgotten authors who were well-known in that day, poets such as Eliza Cook, Lydia Sigourney, Felicia Hemans, Martin Farquhar Tupper, Nathaniel Parker Willis, and George Pope Morris. Fanny tried to write poetry in imitation of all those authors whose works that she studied. Her schoolmates, in turn, tried to write poetry in imitation of Fanny's. There are a few samples of her poetry from this period, but Fanny later passed them off as crude efforts. Although her schoolmates thought at the time that her poems were good verse, she conceded that, in fact, they were not. However, she would send these verses to her mother and grandfather, who doted over them. Crude as these verses may have been, Fanny was considered adept enough at writing poetry to compose the words to a march by Anthony Rife, a sighted music teacher. The march was sung by the very fine institution choir at the laying of the cornerstone for the new institutional building in 1837. The verses do not seem particularly bad for a 17-year-old girl, especially one with only 2 years of formal education, and significantly, this first major poetic effort of which we have a record was a hymn. It goes like this: "This day may every bosom feel a thrill of pleasure and delight. Its scenes will in our memories dwell when time shall wing his rapid flight." Well, soon, however, Fanny's instructors noticed that she was developing a swelled head. This was brought to the attention of Dr. Silas Jones, who had replaced Russ as superintendent in 1836, and he called Fanny into his office one morning. She entered expecting that a new ode or other kind of lyric was to be ordered to the honor of some distinguished person or event. She was flabbergasted when Jones gave her a grave lecture about depending on the favor and laudation of the world. "Do not think too much about rhymes and the praises that come from them. Store your mind with useful knowledge, and think more of what you can be than of how you can appear." But his words, Fanny recalled, quote, were bombshells in the camp of my self-congratulatory thoughts. Hot tears came to her eyes, but soon she recovered sufficiently to throw her arms around his neck and kiss him on the forehead. "You talk to me as my father would have talked if he were living, and I thank you for it." Now, whether or not Fanny's pride was checked immediately is not clear, but in the weeks and months and years that followed, the quality of her poetry rapidly improved. Before she was 20, she was the institution's most promising pupil, a young lady who not only wrote poetry, but in addition to the guitar, which she had learned to play as a child, she was proficient at the piano, organ, and harp. She had the reputation of being one of the finest harpists in America. Life progressed smoothly for Fanny during the late 1830s. These years at the institution were pleasant ones, filled with hard work, as well as pleasant diversion. A high-spirited girl, she later said she was sure to be a part of any mischief that went on at the school. She would tease the postman mercilessly, hiding his pen and ink in a letter book until he became frantic, but always managing to stay out of his sight. When boys and girls who were tenderly attached, as she said, held spooning sessions, she and other pupils who could play the organ devised preconcerted chords, which they struck to let each other know they were there. When she heard that the institution's crop of watermelons was to be sold to raise money, she and a friend managed to steal a large melon, tricking the gardener by volunteering to listen for thieves while the old man caught a few minutes of sleep. By then she had decided that in order to help support her mother dear, she would become a teacher. Although she was not one of the regular instructors, she was being assigned to teach some of the subjects and skills to newcomers, just as Anna Smith had tried to teach arithmetic to her. Many years later, Imogene Hart, whom she taught in this capacity, reminisced in a letter to Fanny that when she arrived at the institution, 1839, quote, "You were appointed to prepare me to join several classes that were well advanced in their studies. You taught me grammar, geography, and knitting. You also labored very hard to teach me to sing second in the hymn, Come, Ye Disconsolate." End of quote. Dr. Jones became concerned that Fanny was devoting too much of her time to poetry, to the exclusion of her other studies. He decided to determine if she had real talent or if she was one of those people who write hymns and rhymes, that is, because they are poetry lovers. His way of determining this was to forbid writing any poetry for 3 months. He was convinced that if she was a real poet, she could not withstand this trial by fire, but if she were merely a dilettante, the enforced layoff would not faze her. Fanny became so despondent that she could not do anything. After 6 weeks of failure in her lessons, Jones called her to his office and began to reprimand her, demanding the reason for the poor work. Fanny's only excuse was that poetry occupied her thoughts to such an extent that it was impossible to keep her mind on other things when she was forbidden to write it. Jones became convinced that she was a real poet and relented, agreeing to allow her to write poetry if she would pay more attention to the lectures. Shortly after this incident, the confidence of the institution's instructors in Fanny's poetic talent was strengthened by the visit of George Combe, the Scottish phrenologist. As a practitioner of character determination based on the shape and texture of the skull, Combe studied Fanny's head and remarked, "Why, here's a poetess. Give her every advantage. Read the best books to her. Teach her to appreciate the best poetry." It has not been recorded whether or not Combe had been prompted as to Fanny's interests. In any event, Jones took Combe's advice conscientiously and found Fanny a teacher in poetic composition. The teacher was Hamilton Murray, a member of the board of managers, who claimed that while he could not write poetry, he could teach others to do so. Murray read long passages of poetry to Fanny and required her to commit them to memory. He taught the proper use of rhyme, rhythm, and meter, pointed out the defects of her poetry, and had her imitate the works of well-known poets. He was very strict, one day assigning her the task of paraphrasing part of a poem by Nathaniel Parker Willis. Lunch was at noon, and at 11:45 Fanny had not written a word. Murray entered. "Have you written those verses, Fanny?"
"I have not, Mr. Murray."
"Well, Fanny," he said calmly but deliberately, "you understand, no verses, no dinner. It's now 11:55. By noon she had to paraphrase a half dozen lines of blank verse. "I think I must have liked my dinner better than verse-making at that time," she remarked years later. From Murray, Fanny learned not only poetic technique but also rapidity of composition. It was owing to his instruction, or rather discipline, that in later years she was able to whip off as many as a dozen hymns a day. For all that Murray did, Fanny was eternally grateful. Of him she said late in life, quote, "With rare faithfulness and with much kindness, considering that his pupil was not a rich man's daughter, but a poor blind girl just starting in life, he toiled for my benefit. And though I could not pay him in money, he had my heartfelt gratitude. Oh, he has long walked the streets of the great tuneful city, and I hope someday to meet him there, grasp him by the hand, and thank him once more." End of quote. I wanted to finish the whole chapter today, and so I did go over my time a little bit. Thank you for bearing with me. And please join me tomorrow when we will continue another history, a sad one, of one of the enemies of the Christian faith, born only 32 years after Fanny Crosby. Join me then, will you? We started today Psalm 34:19. "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him and her out of them all."